is No More Silence, a podcast dedicated to bringing an end to youth violence in Toledo. This is a youth-led podcast bringing high school and university students together with community leaders and experts to learn about the complex causes of youth violence. Experts will discuss initiatives in the city, trauma-informed communities, opportunity networks, the courage required of nonviolence, and much more. The podcast will bring to light youth experiences that stay hidden to the general community. Adults and youth will also share poetry considering the impact of adultism, which is an adult bias against youth. No More Silence is the result of the RAM Empowerment Project and Fearless Writers, two local programs fostering youth-led activism and knowledge creation.
Welcome to episode 10 of No More Silence Conversations about social media influence. The question posed to adult experts in this episode were designed by high school students as a part of their work in two youth-led advocacy programs, Fearless Writers and RAM Empowerment Project. This episode features a discussion with Bryson Davis, a violence interrupter at Woodward High School, and members of the Rogers High School community discussing the importance to social media to violence escalation and prevention. This episode also includes Matt Foss from University of Toledo, who have been part of creative ways to bring positive stories about individuals in neighborhoods while taking on challenges being faced by Toledo. My name is Hyrule Hadri. I am a student at Rogers High School, a member of Fearless Writers, and a member of RAM Empowerment Project.
My name is Bryson Davis. I am 20 years old, and I'm a violence interrupter with the City of Toledo through the mayor's office, and I'm based at Woodward High School.
And why is social media and violence an important topic to you?
Social media and violence is an important topic to me because social media is something that's been around my whole life and something that I've grown to become familiar with. And, you know, I also do a lot of work with the city, with the Community Action Table. I'm a chair of the Social Media and Conflict Working Group.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the action tables for those that don't know what that is?
Yeah, for those who don't know, the action tables are a monthly meeting that occur every second Tuesday of the month at 5 o'clock. And it's a community of people that address gun violence in the city. And we all contribute to the solution and we all work to inform our 5-year action plan titled Peace in Motion that you can find on the city's website.
What types of social media and violence connections are being experienced by young people in Toledo, especially for us old folks like me? What kind of social media exposure are young people dealing with, and particularly how are they getting sort of representations of violence? Or, you know, can you tell some of us what that looks like?
Yeah, so when it comes to the connection between social media and violence, I think that happens in two major ways. I think that social media can be a driver of violence. It can promote violence and make it more known than it already is. And it also can be a space of origin. Things that manifest into physical violent occurrences in our city may not have started. It probably is interpersonal, but it probably didn't start in person. It probably started on social media. So, like I said, it can be an origin, and it also can be a driver.
Can you give an example of how it's been sort of a catalyst to that? Like, do you have an example?
Yeah. So as of recently, a young lady by the name of Kiamani passed away. And there was a huge conflict on social media between two cities. It was more of an interurban conflict between Toledo and Chicago. And, you know, there was just a lot of disrespect, a lot of grief. And it was all being supported through social media. A lot of people that were arguing never met each other beforehand and only had interactions through social media.
Well, any other connections between social media and violence? The students here tell me about what they watch on social media that's violence related, and like, I don't know if adults know how often they're seeing sort of episodes of violence.
Yes.
Can you describe that a little bit?
A huge connection to reference what you're talking about is understanding your algorithm. The algorithm is, and you know, I'm not a social media content expert, but just from what I understand, it's the kind of content that gets pushed to your specific feed, and everybody's algorithm is, you know, specifically set towards them. And some community of people have recorded experiencing more violent content through social media and, you know, having it push towards a specific demographic a little bit more than others. So that's the connection that's being studied a little bit more.
So it's actual like little video clips of fights or video clips of people holding guns.
It's a little bit more extreme than that. It can even be video clips of, you know, murders and video clips of actually seeing somebody get shot and watching the aftermath and watching how that happens in real time and youth. And I think that, you know, our generation is a little bit more desensitized to that kind of content because it's just something that we've kind of seen since we were young. I think that my first run-in with this kind of content maybe started in middle school.
What can youth do to be more social media literate or better understand some of the things that you're talking about, the algorithms and what's being pushed at them?
You know, when I think about this question, I'd argue that it's hard to find a youth that's not social media literate, that doesn't understand how to use social media or understand what they're seeing. But like I said, if you really want to understand why you're seeing the kind of content that you're seeing, focus on your algorithm, focus on reporting and blocking different things that you don't want pushed towards your feed. And I think that's how you become a little bit more literate. But in terms of understanding social media, like I said, it's hard to find youth that don't.
And so they're very savvy, it sounds like. Very savvy about social media.
Yeah, and if you don't know like an abbreviation or something like that, or you can ask the nearest friend. It's so many different abbreviations and things that are being pushed out every single day, new ones every single day.
So if people want to change their stream, like what's coming to them through their social media, what are ways they can do that? So if they want less violence, what are things they can do?
So there's a option on I think almost all social media platforms where you can report the content that you're viewing for a number of reasons, whether that be it's harmful or it's sexually exploiting someone or something. You know, there's a way that you can report that, and that informs your algorithm on what kind of content that you do want to see. And also it goes down to, you know, what you choose to sit there and watch. Your algorithm picks up on if you watch the video all the way through or not. It picks up on if you watch it for the first 3 seconds and it doesn't catch your interest and you keep scrolling. So it is tailored towards you and towards what you consume. So it starts there.
So any thoughts on how, like, I've heard you talk about like pro-social media.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean?
Pro-social media is, you know, basically just using social media in a pro-social way, pushing out different things to inform other people's algorithm, whether that be a positive message or a hopeful video or maybe even just a song that's pro-social, that's benefiting you and your community. So you can use social media as a tool to combat some of the negative things that are happening on there. The way I see it, social media isn't a bad thing. It's merely a tool. And, you know, as of lately, it's been a tool used to start separation and create chaos and division and whatnot. But it can also be used for good. It can be used to give young people a voice, to give them a platform to share their voice and to be part of the solution.
What can youth do other than what you've already talked about to use social media as a way to help their community?
I think I hit on the main topics, but I'll expound on the using it to create a platform. You can use social media now better than ever to put your voice out there, and it can reach millions of people within a matter of minutes. And it sounds crazy, but it's so true. And you have to be able to take advantage of that and understand that once you have that platform, you're responsible for the content that you push out there, for other people's algorithms, and making sure that that's something that reflects who you are and your morals and your values, and something that, like I say, you want to push out into the world to make it better.
Have you seen social media be used to successfully prevent violence?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because, you know, like I said, I'm a violence interrupter, and part of the job is responding to violent situations and maybe de-escalating situations, mediating conflicts. The one thing that we know when it comes to de-escalating conflicts is that it has to be a relationship established first. You can't go into a conflict or into a situation that you have no relationship in. But the way that me and other people from my team have used social media to help de-escalate some of these tensions is by tapping into people's social networks. So using social media to identify mutual friends. And if you find the right mutual friend, they can be tied in as a third party, as a trusted source to help kind of cool down some of those tensions. So like I said, social media isn't enough. You can't become, you know, they can equip me with the skills to become the best violence interrupter in the world, but there are conflicts that I can't respond to because I don't have the relationship. and I also may not even have the social connection to respond to it. So just, again, using relationships and identifying those relationships through social media is how I use it.
Yeah.
But social media is a community within itself. You know, a lot of people try to push a narrative out that, you know, we have to push to the youth that social media isn't real, and that, you know, what happens on social media isn't a real thing, or isn't as significant as real life. However, you know, social media is a whole nother plane of existence. There's kids that go to this school that are a completely different person when it comes to social media, and it's, you know, socially accepted because that's just another space. So we have to begin to respect it and address it as such.
So are you seeing the students that you work with who you can tell have building protective factors through social media?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think that starting with just having somebody like a violence interrupter, everybody that's just having somebody that's a mentor maybe or a peer support, adding people to your feed that you care about, that you feel like can hold you a little bit more accountable when it comes down to posting things, that may look at you a little bit different if you post the wrong things. I think that that's how they start. Obviously, it's a process. You know, you're not going to take a kid who's been going through everything in the world and, you know, make their social media feed perfect. But, you know, you start with small steps and it builds in increments.
Uh-huh. What types of narratives about youth gun violence can be harmful to prevention work?
Well, this is a good one. Something that I stand on, that I preach to a lot of people, is that, you know, we can't keep on weaponizing resilience. I think I speak on that in a different video of mine, but to weaponize somebody's resilience is to tell them all the time, you know, you're so strong, you know, you've gone through so much, and you've just been doing so well, and ignoring the help that they need and using that as an excuse to not get them the support that they deserve. So, you know, a lot of our kids, especially in the inner city, are resilient and they have gone through a lot, but that's no excuse to leave them in a situation. A lot of times it makes it seem like we enjoy or we're accepting of the conditions that we're in, and that's not the case.
So it ends up being a rationale for not acting as opposed to...
Absolutely.
Yeah. What narratives are you seeing that you think are really helpful to gun violence prevention?
That youth are the answer. I think that the more youth that get involved and become part of the solution on a systemic level, on, you know, in some of these rooms that you may feel like you don't belong in. When I first started my career as a violence interrupter, I was 19, and I was sitting in meetings with directors and commissioners and all these different things. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, this may be a bit much, especially, you know, with me just being high school educated. But as I've grown in my profession, I realized that my experiences and, you know, me living in Toledo have made me a profession within the field, and I'm respected as such. And, you know, I advocate for youth, you know, as young as 14 years old and even younger, to come and be in these rooms and come to action table meetings and come to different social events that can connect you and network with some of these individuals at the city level, at the state level, at the national level, to help be a part of the solutions, because they'll listen to you and they'll respect you.
What would you like every youth to know about social media?
That your digital footprint is a real thing. Understand that there are things that I've posted when I was 16 that I look back now at 20 years old and be like, I was so lame. And, you know, it even on a more extreme level, if you're out there posting guns and posting affiliations and things like that now, you can grow and you can change in the next 10 years, but that stuff is still going to be there. You can delete it. People can screenshot it. You can archive it. People can put it. You just have to understand that the digital footprint is real. So to be cautious of what you put out there into this alternate reality, because it's going to stay there.
My name is Daphne Herford, and I'm a teacher here at Rogers High School. And as I listen to you, I can't help but wonder what your organization and similar organizations do to fight against the shock culture and the culture that glamorizes the violence, the rap stars, the musicians that, you know, feature treating women horribly and showing off guns. What are you guys doing to fight against that?
When it comes to certain situations, it's hard to respond to everything, because like I said, it all starts with relationships. When we're talking about the rappers and the little babies and the every baby out there that you can think of, we don't have the connections to tap in with them to help influence their music, but we do have the connections to tap in with the people in Toledo who are making music that may be disrespectful and may be glamorized. I think that we have to understand that this is a issue that's bigger than the individual. It's a systemic issue. These narratives, these different things that you're talking about, they're being monetized. And that's what's putting food on the table. So if we're going to tell a young man who's making risky music, who may be getting a lot of support for it and maybe even getting paid for it, we have to replace that risk factor with another protective factor. And so, you know, our job as violence interrupters, our job with the city is to identify those risk factors and find different pro-social factors to replace them with. For example, we're partnered with 50 Way, with 50 Way Studios, and they have a connection with the court system to where any court-appointed youth can apply to be part of that studio, and they'll go there to create music, and they can really only make pro-social music. So that's an idea, that's a start, that's a push in the right direction. You know, we can't control their center of influence when they're not in our space, when they're not in the school or around the team and whatnot, but we can leave them with different skills, with different, you know, things that we've been trained up on to help them identify some of those unhealthy thought processes and replace those with certain skills to get them out of that. You know, we're training things like the think, feel, do cycle, and helping them realize that when they put that harmful content into their consciousness, that it makes them think of a certain way, it makes them feel a certain way, and then in turn it will make them do a certain thing.
My name is Adriana Davis. I'm a senior and I go to Rogers High School. And I think with what you said, Ms. Herford, like the music, like the type of music, you know, like all this we listen to and be making, I think it's good, but it's kind of, I feel like more music like that, if it's not like, I don't know, what's his name?
King Von.
Oh yeah, King Von. That's what I was trying to think of. King Von. Yeah, he was notorious. But I think more music that's not like that, or but still like has probably violent undertones, more like a coping mechanism. Because I've used that music before too, just to let my feelings out. Because it doesn't always have to be just reckless violence. It could be like, because it could be like rap that's like a story, like
storytelling.
Yeah, storyteller rap. Yeah.
So music sometimes it's cathartic, right? So mm-hmm. if you're feeling really angry, like listening to angry music helps.
So it prevents you to do that.
Yeah. So not everybody's listening to violent things mm-hmm. to be violent, or and they don't, you know, it's really to maybe express emotions that are also important to do.
I have a young man that I work with, and, you know, I'm not going to say his name or anything like that, but some people at the table may know who he is, and he makes music in the city. And he explained to me, he said, Mr. Bryce, you know, I make this music, and the music when I'm out dissing and making, you know, antagonizing people and name dropping, is that's the music that's getting hundreds of thousands of views, and that's what's getting me paid. But the music when I talk about how I feel after losing my brother, and the music I talk about how I feel, you know, losing both of my parents before 16, that music maybe hit at most 30,000 views, but that's it. So how do I not make this music no more? I don't have any other skills. I don't know what else to do. So it's like, on one hand, and I don't advocate for music that advocates for violence. However, I do understand expression. And when you're in an environment where the only expression that you see and the only success that you see is that kind of success and that kind of expression, it's not a mystery to me why they go towards it. However, it's really about switching out those risk factors, you know, and you can't do that without relationships. So that's why I just stress that it's not my job to stop the violence. It's my job to create relationships and help them understand that that's not the life that they need to be associated with anymore. It's speculation on whether it's working or not. However, it's something that we take very seriously, and something that we foster these relationships, and we open these spaces we open these safe places for our students and give them a chance to express themselves in a different way. So hopefully that starts the process.
Peyton Robinson, and I'm a senior. I know you said that there's a digital footprint. Does that include when someone deletes an account or multiple other accounts? Does that include other apps in a games, such as violent games? Does the violence in the game affect how they communicate or how they act in real life? Would that make them more violent or have more violent tendencies?
Okay, so to answer your first question, for deleted accounts, Absolutely. Like I said, even if you delete content, if you delete an account, the footprint of what, if I post something right now and delete it 1 second later, there's no telling how many people seen that. And if it's interesting enough, if it's risky enough, if it's engaging enough, people are going to screenshot that and it will be around forever. So understanding that even if you have a Finsta or a fake account or whatever, you know, that can still be traced back to you. Even there's some students that I have that have social media accounts that have nothing to really do with their person in real life. You know, they don't identify by their actual name on there. They go by alias. They don't have their actual picture on there, if they have any pictures at all. And they try to post, you know, things that don't really tie it specifically to them. So even then, within your network of people that you know, somebody's going to know that that account is connected to you. So it's just always going to be out there. So that's why you got to be super careful. And to answer the next question, when it comes to the violent video games, from what I understand, I don't think that there's a way to, you know, track what kind of games you have. I mean, if somebody really wants to know, I think they'll really go through the measures to find out. But I think I personally do believe that the content that you consume, the things that you watch and engage in, do affect your behavior or do inform your behavior. You know, some people have more morals, some people have better standards, and some people won't let different things affect them. But if you consume certain content over and over for a specific amount of time, I think that you'll start to internalize it a little bit. Games like GTA and different things like that, I think it's important to keep them away from younger kids that are still malleable, that still have that are still being sponges.
He is mostly right about how there's a reason why we put E for everyone and M for mature on games and everything, like GTA and everything. But it also depends on how the game approaches the violence. Because for GTA, because sometimes mindless killing does a processing, right? It's just pixels. Because sometimes it won't even process like that. And you won't even think about it. But more like something more realistic or mature, like you do actual steps or something, that's actually like scary for your mind to take in and everything. Because there's a difference between mindless violence and violence that's like actually tangible and something like that. That's what I was thinking, because I've seen that so many times. I even watched a video on it, and somebody like did a whole study on it from multiple studies from before that they've tried to do. And they said that, like, not really, but also not fully. You can't really get a clear-cut answer for that question. At least not yet. You can't get a clear-cut.
Coming from different angles, there's, like, I think that's true anytime there's, like, a media shift, or same thing about social media, right? There'll be competing research often. So it can be very confusing to figure out what's best, because you'll see research that really sort of conflicts with. So if even when you're trying to do your due diligence around some of the stuff, it's hard because you'll see research that says yes and no, yes and no, yes and no.
Also, I feel like I have an example for more like what I mean by senseless violence and then like something that's like premeditated into something that you plan out. Because if I were to say if I'm playing like GTA, if I just pull out my thing, shoot somebody, and then nothing happens, really. Actually, the freaking cops are lax. But for you to, like, because you actually have to go through effort to actually, like, be, like, a sneaky, like, actual killer or something like that. Like, you would, not even, like, in stealth missions. If you were just trying to, like, dispose of a body or something, you actually have to put effort into it. That's more of a scary reason to look at something like that. But I don't think it's more of the game's fault for that, because there's reason they have elements in there. It just depends on how the person uses it. If they use it in that way, that's you're weird. You're weird, man. Swear.
Could I ask do you think that it's because they may be desensitized? Because, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, if you put your feet in the shoes of somebody, we'll just say 50 years ago, you know, even if they just seen somebody pull out a PS5 and play GTA and shoot somebody, like, bro, why'd you just shoot that guy? Like, what's, like, could you imagine somebody seeing that for the first time? But we've seen it since we were 3 years old. So it's like, do you think that we may be a little desensitized to that?
I feel like it's most definitely that, actually. Because I swear, there are multiple people probably in here that have seen crazy stuff on there when they be looking, but not unprovoked, literally. You'll go on, I swear to God, I remember I went on Instagram or something, went on somebody's old account. It was just like, it was censored, but I could still look at it. I was like, okay, probably nothing that bad. It was literally like somebody crashing into a bus. I was like, why wasn't it deleted? I was so, like, shocked. My freaking jaw dropped. I was like, that's an actual thing happening. Isn't that scary, Ms. Hayford?
I was just wondering, what does Rogers do that could improve Woodward in a non-violent sense? And what can Woodward do to teach us?
Man, when you ask that question, you know, my mind goes in different places because, you know, I just graduated from Rogers in 2022, so I feel like I may have a good sense of how the school kind of operates still. And then going to work at Woodward, you know, still, you know, early 20s, you know, it's hard because every school has a different dynamic. Every school is really different. And when I was in school, I didn't recognize that. I thought that every school kind of went the same way. I only went to Rogers my own 4 years. So I thought that every school was the same way. But the way that the kind of trauma that Rogers is exposed to, Woodward may not be exposed to. The kind of trauma Woodward is exposed to, Rogers may not be exposed to at the extent that they are, and vice versa. And so when it comes to like mirroring efforts, I don't really think that may be the answer. However, I don't see a lot of things or initiatives like the REM empowerment program at a lot of these different TPS schools and giving students a voice and giving them a platform to speak on things that they feel like. And I think that things like this is something that can be done district-wide. I think that this is a great idea. So I would take this page out of y'all book. And as for what Rogers could learn from Woodward, I know I spoke about weaponizing resilience earlier. However, I do want to take the time to highlight how resilient the kids at Woodward really are. Not to say that, you know, kids, I think that the whole Toledo is resilient. If you're from the mud, then you know what it feels like. However, the kind of resilience that these kids have to go through. Last year, they lost a student right after exams. Like, they took their exam, left early because it's an exam day. Student got killed around noon and then came back the next day. Everybody get to class on time, it's exam day. So, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, we'd have to, I would advocate for, you know, pushing through trauma and not addressing that. However, I think it's huge to highlight how resilient these kids are and how much they go through and still, you know, come to school. And I think that's a testament to how much they care and how much they want to do better. And even though the stereotype may not represent that.
So what can schools, I mean, both of you are bringing up a really important thing. What, like, you know, there's school rivalries and there's, you know, football teams, basketball teams that like compete, but what could schools in the district do for each other when something like there's a loss at a school? What would be supportive? Like, is there ways that Rogers could be supportive to Woodward when that stuff happens? Or are the rivalries too ingrained to broach some of that?
I don't think it's really a matter of rivalries, you know, stopping the support. I just think that it's, you know, the different demographic of people involved at both schools. You know, kids at Woodward may never have met or never will meet kids at Rogers just because, you know, there's kind of like a distance barrier. So I think that just showing support, you know, letting the district know, letting, you know, every TPS school know that there was a loss and that there's something that we should be sensitive about when it comes to a certain school. And even down to something cool we've been working on is like a handle with care notification for specific students that are going through a trauma or a traumatic event, and it will flag them as somebody who should be handled with care throughout the day.
Yeah. So, is there a way a whole school could be designated this handle with care?
Man, I wish.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just too many people. But like I said, I think that having being supportive, just being there. This is a word that I learned when I joined the job, being high impact, low maintenance. So, you know, it's not really a lot that can be done right now unless it's asked for. But, you know, always be around, always be an ear. Let the rest of the schools know, and maybe even drop off a card and just show district support. Because sometimes when stuff like this happens, and I've heard it from the students themselves, that they feel like it's Woodward against the world. Like, nobody really cares about them. So just showing that, you know, we're thinking about y'all.
This is Hyder Al-Hedry, and we're going to speak to Matt Foss from the University of Toledo Theater Program.
My name is Matt Foss, and I'm a professor in the Department of Theater and Film at the University of Toledo and the Artistic Director of Public Works Collaborative, a non-for-profit arts organization here in Toledo that's focused on amplifying stories of our community, particularly those stories that are not being told and definitely are not being heard.
Tell us a little about the short film Sons of Toledo and the impact it has had since the early screenings.
We were the production company behind Sons of Toledo. Sons of Toledo started with a project at the Toledo Museum of Art called Art of the Cut, which was about Black-owned barbershops in our city and their work as on the front lines of being community advocates and advocates for a lot of the health of the men and women that sit in their chairs. But during the pandemic, you know, we could not meet publicly, but these stories persisted. And so the guys at the shop says, well, how are we going to tell this story? And someone said, well, we should make a movie. Do you know how to do that? And I said, we don't, but we'll learn how to. And so we hired a production crew out of Chicago to partner with Madhouse Films here in town and then created a process that was focused on making sure that every moment of the film was authored and authentic by the people who were living it. So it was written in the barbershops, often plugging the computer right into the TV and them saying, yes, that's right. That's our story as we went through. We premiered the film in a number of ways. One, at some top-tier film festivals while doing community-focused screenings at Toledo Public Libraries, schools, barbershops. And we wanted to make sure, despite the fact that it was on, you know, the seatback players on United Airlines, that everyone in Toledo could have access to it. It could be a tool. There were screenings with first responders and barbers having conversations about gun violence in this community. And you can see it now free of charge on WGTE's website. It's a community story, so we want it to be a community resource.
Why do you think this narrative has resonated with the Toledo community?
I think the narrative resonated so much with the community because it was written and created by, for, and with the community. There's no actors inside except for one mother because the real mother was Paula Hick Hudson and was at the State House, so we had to replace her last minute. She does get to show up in one of the documentary sections. But it's community-sourced, community-based, and community-focused in that there's no actors. These are all people that you might see in the grocery store, might see at the barbershop. And so in the process of creating it, there were very principled safeguards of why we're doing this that informed how we went about doing to make sure that people were in charge of the story that was being made. So we did have guest experts, but they did not interpret the expertise of those who had lived these stories and lived through these stories and were navigating through them and thriving despite some very difficult moments.
What is important to keep in mind when working to capture authentic human experience as part of a story that stands in for a larger community?
So often storytellers think that the first action in telling a story is talking, and I would say the first should be listening. In fact, maybe first through fourth should be listening. Barbers understand this. Bartenders understand this better than a lot of people, of how important listening is to good storytelling and that good stories beget good stories. And so luckily, we started at this listening place, but we also would circle back to make sure that we never missed an opportunity to listen, to make sure that we were staying on track to an authentic representation of this story throughout the film.
What have been some of the pitfalls of creating an honest portrayal of an individual faced with the realities of gun violence?
When you're working with, for, and by a community, you're going to be navigating the needs that are immediately impacting that community. So when we're making the film, we're dealing with everything from food insecurity to safety to making sure that we are organizing any event we do to not get in the way of important life events. And some of those life events is just earning hours. These shops, they have a finite amount of time where they can not only serve the community and provide a vital role, but also make their living to pay their bills. So we needed to make sure that our shoot dates never competed with when the shops needed to be open. We needed to make sure that the resources were locally sourced, not only from the meals, But everything we could do could be local to keep not only the story authentic to the community, but the resources that are used to fund that storytelling in the community as well. And when you're dealing with a topic that has an urgency around it as gun violence, you can't take for granted the courage they have to talk about these very difficult subjects.
Is there more that you would like to add?
Our hope, particularly at the University of Toledo and Public Works, is that storytelling and art and the creative things should be a utility, not a commodity. A utility that's available to all rather than a commodity that's only available to those who can afford it. This is a strongly Toledo principle. Our museum, our arts commission, like this is our 1% for public art. This idea of the creative is a public right, a public tool that should be available to all is really important. And so that was vital for us with this film to make sure, particularly when it's so difficult to discuss issues like gun violence, if you start with something like Once Upon a Time, which we tried to, Sons of Toledo, that has a lot of space for people to fill in the blanks with their own lived experience, we thought that could be a better tool for catalyzing difficult and hopefully more impactful conversations. And you can check it out at WGTE. It's streaming there free, so it can be exactly that, a public utility, a story utility for all of Toledo.
We would like to thank WGTE and the producer of Voices Around Us, Chris Pfeiffer, for the opportunity to share our stories. Thank you to Bryson Davis, Wendy Esler, Deshaun Head, Daphne Herford, Matt Foss, Heather Cleary, and Tina DeBoard for their support of this event. Please join us for episode 11, final adultism episode, featuring adult and youth members of Fearless Writers Community Empathy Write. I'm Haider Al-Hajri, and you have been listening to No More Silence.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.